From economics to the woke agenda, this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, today's breaking news alert. New study, as reported by Science Magazine, so you know it's promoting the science. Clearer skies are accelerating global warming. Declining pollution is causing temperatures to rise. Yes, and you thought all those environmental restrictions were going to save the Earth and save us from bad health. Well, apparently they're accelerating the climate change because the cleaner we make our air, the more dangerous the climate becomes. Quote, Earth's skies are getting clearer and letting in more sunshine, unquote. So now they're acknowledging that the sun heats the climate. The more sun, the more heat. The cleaner the air, the more global warming. It's incredible. This is a study published in the Communications Earth and Environment, and it suggests one reason for global warming is the skies are getting clearer, letting in more sunshine. It was prompted, this study, by NASA instruments in space. NASA's all behind this study. And they claim scientists have long known pollution declines can lead to warming. Interesting, because and that's consistent because in the 1970s, before fossil fuels caused global warming, fossil fuels caused man-made global cooling. In the 1970s, they were worried about the aerosols of our fossil fuel use blocking out the sun and creating global cooling, man-made global cooling, so much so they wanted to put soot on the Arctic. NASA scientists, Stephen Schneider, many other prominent scientists, CIA reports, Newsweek, Time, all warned of an impending ice age, man-made global warming, man-made global cooling. And we even had Leonard Nimoy, who played a Spock, do a documentary in search of on the coming ice age and essentially this cold wave that's hitting us. And of course, they later said that never happened. They whitewashed history. Even the author of the Newsweek piece in 1975 was forced to recant his journalism 40 years later. I'm not making that up. He did an article based on the science of the day and then later had to recant and say, we didn't know enough back then. I shouldn't have wrote what I wrote. This was years ago. He did this. It was incredible. And what was amazing about that 1975 Newsweek article, by the way, was it repeated all the same stuff you hear today. Yes, we only have a limited time. We have tipping points. They blamed extreme weather on man-made global cooling. They blamed any bad weather event around the world. They wanted to geoengineer the climate like they did. It's incredible. They wanted to do wealth redistribution. I have a whole chapter in my book, Green Fraud, about them wanting to essentially impose a primitive version of the Green New Deal in the 1970s. Central planning, wealth transformation, sovereignty limiting treaties, all to stop that menace of man-made global cooling. Well, here we've come full circle. Since the first Earth Day, we have radically improved air quality, particularly here in the United States. Well, I shouldn't say we. Not necessarily globally, but in the United States, Western nations have radically improved their air quality. Obviously not India, China, Brazil, developing, especially rapidly developing industrialized countries have sewers for air, particularly China and Chinese cities. But the Western world, because we had wealth, capitalism, free markets, technology, were able to radically clean up our air and water quality. The World Health Organization says the U.S. has among the cleanest air in the world. Well, guess what? It's accelerating global warming. You don't want to breathe smog? You are a grandma killer because you're creating more warming, which will create more viruses. Anyway, that's just one of the silly paradoxes here about global warming. I'm not sure what they want us to do in the end. Let's clean up our environment. Oh, no, that's bad for the climate. No, your head can spin. Okay. I got to talk about this. This is Governor Whitmer. We've talked about this on Unleashed many times. Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan was one of the most tyrannical governors during COVID. I mean, to the point where she was blocking out, you couldn't do gardening in stores. They had plastic, police tape covering off aisles. They didn't want true Orwellian, tyrannical, totalitarian control of society. She's a wannabe dictator. She's not even a wannabe. She was a dictator. She banned people from traveling. Then it was found out she went to her second home on Lake Michigan or some resort during COVID when there's supposed to be stay-at-home orders, but she's the governor. She can do what she needs. Part of the rehabilitation of this image of her was to make her a victim. And I'm not saying the FBI planned it as part of rehabilitation, but for whatever reason, the FBI got involved and they claimed these, I'm just going to say it, backwoods militia members who were literally virtually homeless, destitute, poor, alcoholics. They're not, I shouldn't say they're alcoholics, but they were essentially a bunch of good old boys who had a Michigan militia. And the FBI meets with them, starts organizing them, FBI undercover agents, and starts funding them, starts helping and facilitating this whole plot to kidnap her with a few of these networks. And it was the FBI pushing it. It was so bad that the judge and the jury apologized to the men that the FBI would ever do anything like this. So now there's a new movie coming out called Kidnap and Kill, an FBI terror plot. I'd love to get the producer or one of the people, actors or someone in this film. This is clip one. You can watch the FBI was behind the plot to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer all along. This is like someone saying, hey, I saved you from that, you know, saved you from being hit by that car when you're the person who pushed him out in front of the car. That's what the FBI engaged in. But watch this. It's, it's about a minute and a half clip of the movie trailer, and it looks really good. I've not seen the full movie yet, but I intend to. Clip one.
Earlier today, Attorney General Dana Nessel was joined by officials from the Department of Justice and the FBI to announce state and federal charges against 13 members of two militia groups who were preparing to kidnap and possibly kill me.
We're grateful to the FBI and law enforcement to discover these domestic terrorists and stop them. You know, it's the sort of behavior you might expect from ISIS.
You might see a number that high in a sprawling narcotics conspiracy that stretches from coast to coast and beyond. That's a pretty high number in a case like this. It really reflects, I think, how deeply the government has been diving into this investigation to try to make these cases.
It was just literally a bunch of working class guys who, on the weekend, got together and, you know, exercise their rights and trained with firearms. So the FBI says, hey, we'll just pay for everything.
Who arranged the meeting? The FBI's paid provocateur. Robeson was getting paid to set this stuff up.
So they make the route, they set the locations, they make the plan, they do everything, and Adam's literally just sitting in the basement of a vacuum repair shop smoking blunts all day.
You're going to hear that my client was the leader of this group. But I think you're also going to hear that there was an election held to identify the leader, and it was Dan.
How can I frame this social situation to make this naive person appear to be a dangerous, violent terrorist? The whole goal was for the FBI to spend millions of dollars to create militia groups, record them saying offensive stuff, and then frame them in a fake conspiracy.
Movie looks really good. Kidnap and Kill, FBI terror plot. This is us versus the deep state. And this was done as a psyop, again, turning a wildly unpopular governor, Gretchen Whitmer, into a victim. And now everyone, I remember in the media, other governors calling, giving their, oh my gosh, you were about to be kidnapped. These evil right-wing militias, we really need to crack down on them. We need more censorship. It's because of the misinformation that these people thrive. And now they're coming after and advocating violence and trying to kill and kidnap governors. You get the idea. And it turns out it was an FBI plan all along. I wouldn't even use the word entrapment. It was the FBI. The FBI should be arrested for threatening Gretchen Whitmer, not Gretchen Whitmer. Okay, clip two, as part of this whole change in, I guess, progressivism, liberalism, whatever you want to call it, free speech is frightening. Tucker Carlson details how he was not allowed to speak. This is his alma mater. This is his, I guess he went to a private boarding high school, and he was not allowed to come back. So he ended up doing a Zoom call, but here's Tucker Carlson explaining the forces against free speech in academia and how they treated him. It's a pretty remarkable story. Clip two.
I find, and I found honestly in my exchanges with the administration at St. George's, a total resistance to having anybody who they don't agree with, even in the same world. Like, I'm not on your campus right now because the campus that I went to and donated to and sent my three children to, because they wouldn't let me come. And why wouldn't they let me come? Well, of course, because they hate my politics. And my feeling was, well, you know, that's wrong. First of all, I want to be there. I want to meet the kids. I want to see the kids. And I feel it could be good for everyone to have this happen. And I don't want a mandatory chapel where everyone has to come and hear me. I don't believe in that. I don't want to press my views on people who don't want to hear them. Let's just have an event where everyone who wants to come can come. And people who don't want to come don't have to come. I don't think you should, again, I don't think you should force your views on anyone. I don't believe in that, okay? I really don't believe in that. They did it to me at St. George's and I didn't like it. And I said so at the time. And so I tried to get a straight answer from the school, like, well, can I come or can I not? No one would answer. So I finally called the head's office. He wouldn't call me back for like over a week. So I called again, he finally called me back. And I said, can I come or not? I could not get a straight answer. And knowing, of course, it was political, but it was like hilarious, the lengths that they went to keep me from doing this. And so I said, but what is the problem? And ultimately, the headmaster, Mr. Wirtz, as he called himself to me, says, well, we're worried you would garnish national media attention. I was like, garnish? Like the parsley on your steak? What are you even talking about? I think you mean garner. I was like, do you really run, say, is this really the headmaster? Do you really run that school? Anyway, so, and I said, but if Oprah wanted to come, was more famous than I am, could she come? Whoa, that's a theoretical. Anyway, I can't get an answer. So then I get another call from a board member, and he's like, well, actually, the real problem is the students don't want you to come. They don't like you. They're embarrassed to tell you. They just don't want to see you. They think you're kind of embarrassing. They don't want you to come. And I was like, okay, you're not hurting my feelings, but this Henry kid seems smart. If he wants me to come, then I'll go sit in a basement room and I'll talk to Henry for an hour and I'll leave. No, you can't. Just wait another year. I was like, this is really crazy.
Tucker on fire there. He says he was banned. This is his prep school, St. George's School in New England. And he even offered, you know, they said, oh, there might be violence. And he said, well, I'll bring in armed guards. No, we don't allow guns on campus, even our security. And he's like, how could that be? And he goes, what if Joe Biden or Kamala Harris came? And that, of course, they would allow the Secret Service to carry guns. I mean, they gave every answer. And that's good of Tucker. That was actually his Zoom talk to the school that he released to make fun of the school. And I love that you're going to, you know, I think he said garnish publicity, and then they meant to say garner, and he's like, do you really run this school? That was brilliant, Tucker Carlson there, just illustrating absurd behavior by mocking them and exposing them like a shining light. Okay, another story here. Jeff Bezos, and this will lead into this story, he's accused of running a fake Amazon grocery store. They were called Fresh, and I actually went into one with my daughter one time. She was all excited, and the idea is, you go around and it's like a regular grocery store, but you load everything in your cart and it like scans it automatically and you go on out. You don't have to go through a checkout line, no lines, no scanning each item. It just sort of picks it all up. But the key is, this is Jeff Bezos. And on a related story, Washington Post owner, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos just bought a $90 million mansion, and I'm not making this up, on a man-made barrier island in Florida, despite his own newspaper, the Washington Post, constantly hyping man-made climate sea level rise. This, by the way, is his third mansion in Florida. He's on a buying spree. And it's amazing because this is how you look at people like Barack Obama, President Obama, who bought it in Hawaii, and he's actually violating local environmental rules by ripping out a seawall that he doesn't like because it's ugly and it affects his property. They just don't seem to be that worried about the sea level rise. Well, anyway, Jeff Bezos and Amazon, they've now been forced to admit that their grocery store was totally fake. This is clip 4, which will explain what this is all about.
You may recall that Amazon rolled out with great fanfare these quote unquote just walk out grocery stores where you go in, you just put the stuff in your cart. They allegedly had this high tech that was scanning things as you were placing them in your cart. You walk out, it charges your card, you get your receipt, you're done. You don't even have to go through a checkout line. Well, they just announced that they're killing this just walk out tech. And the reason is because it never actually really worked. In reality, this, you know, sophisticated AI, et cetera, was really powered by somewhere around 1,000 human beings who were watching and checking what you were putting in your basket and making sure that you were getting charged for the right things, who were based in India.
And that was a news report from the news source, Breaking Points. Very well done. What's funny about this is now we have artificial intelligence, AI, that's fake. They're using 1,000 Indian workers, probably low paid given Amazon's history and all that, you know, and although that's not relevant to the story, but they're using that to claim it's artificial intelligence and it's high tech. And all it is as low tech as you can get, of course, riddled with problems. And I love the fact that they were forced to admit this. And I never went back. I went to the grocery store once. It was actually sometime during the mask mandates and they were mask Nazis. I didn't wear a mask and my daughter didn't wear a mask in there. But they had signs everywhere, no entry. They didn't enforce it the day I was there, but it's like, who needs it? I can go to my local grocery store. Anything, remember this, in this day and age, anything that's corporate, national, retail is going to be doing the forces of the deep state, the Great Reset, and they're going to be the ones enforcing it. The mom and pops aren't going to be following this. So I tried to not support those giant retail chains like that. Okay, clip five is Pete Buttigieg actually being challenged on CNBC. This is Joe Kernan, who's great. He retweets my stuff a lot. He's great. He's with us on climate. He is challenging him on the border, and Pete Buttigieg is trying to spew out a bunch of silly talking points from the Biden administration. Clip five.
That didn't come until it became clear it was going to be a major campaign issue. And only then did the Biden administration get interested in it. And every time I hear every time we hear those talking points that suddenly it was Republicans who ruined the border, that's why people get so frustrated. We know what President Biden said about inviting people in. We know that he got rid of all the things that were keeping the border closed that President Trump had put in. We know that he got rid of all those. So when you say it's not his fault,
Did you see
7.2 million people come in during the Trump administration? It was a trickle.
He got rid
of
the policy to tear children out of the arms of their parents. That's true. But it is not true. Some of the other things that have been suggested. Let's be clear. Bipartisan efforts of border reform
with why there's a
have
disconnect,
taken place
I
in
think.
2015, 2006.
Okay. I love that Pete Buttigieg comes from the school. Just keep talking and blathering out your points. One of the first things Joe Biden did was executive orders, loosening a lot of President Trump's immediate on the border. And then, of course, continued that whole policy. And by the way, the children in boxes was a policy that began under President Obama. And it was actually exaggerated to that extent. Anyway, it was about that whole thing is silly. But that's an example of at least a reporter, and that's CNBC, corporate media, pushing back. All right, final clip, and then we're going to get to our guest, Jeffrey Tucker, which I'll introduce here in a moment. We'll take a break and then go to Jeffrey Tucker. But before we do that, great clip by RFK Jr. He keeps saying he's the most articulate presidential candidate. Of course, that's not saying as much, but you got Donald Trump, Joe Biden, and RFK Jr. But actually, any candidate who ran major party, minor party, only Vivek Ramaswamy, in my mind, made more sense to him than equaled RFK Jr.'s eloquence. But here's the latest clip of RFK Jr. just letting it out. The stakes are too high to back down. Clip three.
They're also worried that, you know, what my sister said, that, you know, my candidacy may get Trump elected.
What happens if it does? What happens if you wake up the day after the election, we have results, and that is what happened? Will you regret it?
What I said to you applies to that. I don't think either President Trump or President Biden are going to solve the debt crisis in this country, which is existential. Yeah. I don't think either of them are going to get us out of foreign wars. This addiction that we have to forever wars. I don't think that either of them are capable of ending the corporate capture of all of our agencies, the capture of the CIA by the military-industrial complex, the capture of NIH, CDC, and FDA by the pharmaceutical companies, the capture of USDA by processed food and big ag. They're not going to do anything about that. So it's going to be more of the same, whoever gets elected. There's going to be changes around the margins. You know, tax on abortion or whatever.
Okay.
Both of them only have 4 years, and I don't think they can dismantle democracy in 4 years. I think Americans' institutions are too great for that, and the chance for me to actually change the nature of governance in this country, to restore democracy, to restore our nation's moral authority abroad, give us a foreign policy that's not based on war or projecting military power abroad, but on projecting economic power and moral strength. The chances of that happening are too great and too important for me to give up this contest.
All right. Bobby Kennedy, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
Aaron, thanks for having me.
And I'm impressed. He's still getting on CNN, and he's nailing it out there with truth bomb after truth bomb. He's doing very well. And I do think the Trump campaign needs to be worried about RFK Jr. And I think a lot of the worry about, his liberal running mate, I think she's apparently, according to, I think it was one of the major networks, she's pretty much disappeared from the campaign trail, his running mate from San Francisco. And she is, I think, going to be a silent partner. So if he keeps going out there like this, I mean, he's going to resonate with huge portions. I just don't know about his funding and about his ballot access and media access and everything else. But anyway, when we come back, we'll take a break. We're going to have Jeffrey Tucker, founder, author, president of the Brownstone Institute, also author of 10 books, including Life After Lockdown. He was one of the go-to, most articulate anti-lockdown voices who I was reading all the time, quoting. I quoted him extensively in my book, The Great Reset. Jeffrey Tucker will be welcome back to the program here on TNT. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Stay tuned.
TNT's Jason Burmess.
Peace through strength. Now, on its surface, it sounds very good, right? Well, we're going to have a strong military and a strong defense, and that is going to bring us peace. But when you just scratch the surface a little itty bitty bit, what do they say? They say things like, we've got to give Ukraine the weapons they need to do the job. That would be impossible because there are no amount of weapon systems we can give Ukraine to end the conflict in Russia. Period. Full stop. I'm in a place called reality. So that is not an answer. That is an establishment moment that lets me know they're riding the flow of whatever will keep them in office, keep them on television, and keep them empowered.
Jason Burmess on today's News Talk, TNT.
The Light is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
We don't rock. We talk. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, welcome to the program now. Jeffrey Tucker, founder, author, president of the Brownstone Institute, author of 10 books, including Life After Lockdown. He has been one of the most articulate and consistent voices against the madness that descended upon the once free West since March of 2020. Welcome back to TNT, Jeffrey.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
All right. Where do we stand now? We're almost halfway through 2024. You've been following the COVID tyranny. You've been following the free speech tyranny. You've been following to the extent of all of our crazy government policy, the intentional rationing of energy, food, transportation, free speech. They're coming after money supply, digital current, central bank, digital currency. Are we in a position, as when I say we, the forces of resistance, people fighting back, are we winning this battle or are we getting hammered and facing a dystopian future? Where do you think we stand?
You know, it's hard to say. For one thing, the lockdowns unleashed the totalitarians like nothing we've ever seen in our lifetime or really any generation of Americans. We've never seen this level of censorship, but they closed our churches, schools, businesses. restricted our travel, even our ability to move from state to state. So if you can do that, what aren't you willing to do? And we're learning what they can do and are willing to do. They've basically nationalized social media. It's very difficult to find free speech anywhere on the internet anymore. They've transformed this beautiful technology of the internet into a propaganda vehicle, 95% of it anyway. And they're inflating away the value of the dollar with their money printing. And that is getting worse, not better, contrary to all the lies we've been told for 3 years now. I'm so sick of it. You know, every day somebody's lying to you about everything. We've got a collapsing infrastructure around the country. We've got a real estate crisis developing in our cities. The learning loss among young people, the ill health of the population, the vaccine injury that everybody's denying, on and on and on it goes. There's just no end to it. So that's on one hand. On the other hand, we're seeing now the development of a kind of population-wide resistance like we've never experienced in our lifetime. I've never seen anything like it, really. And it's not left or right. It really is just a kind of a resentment against the elites. And a bold determination to forge ahead with basic rights and liberties, regardless of what we face. So this clash is ongoing, and it's fascinating to watch all the ways in which it's playing itself out. For one thing, the uncensored media venues are growing in traffic, and the censored venues are losing in traffic dramatically. And we're seeing huge cuts in mainstream media. They're having to shed staff. I mean, they've got a long way to go, but already they're screaming in pain from Los Angeles Times to NPR, New York Times, you name it. They're all screaming right now because they're losing market share. So in the marketplace, our ideas and our institutions are kind of winning. But that is also provoking, on the other hand, the bad guys to sort of double down on censorship and on the subsidies of green energy and so on. So it really is like the new movie that's out in theaters today. It's a kind of a civil war, maybe a cold style civil war, but it's real, it's authentic, and it defines our lives.
Wow. So let's go back, 2019. What would you give the state of the Western world, the state of the United States? Were we dramatically better, or were things just as bad and they were just masked by the fact that, you know, we were in good economy and we weren't dealing with a COVID? In other words, was that a utopian versus where we are today, a dystopia? Or was it, again, was it just, were we deluding ourselves back pre-COVID 2019 that things were a lot better than they were?
I go back and forth on this point a lot. It seemed to me that in 2019 that there were a lot of problems, but things were more or less fixable. I didn't think everything was broken, and I didn't imagine that we had cultivated a generation of sort of insulated elites who imagined that they would reconstruct the world such that they could sit at home on their sofas, get paid tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars, do nothing, and force the working classes to drop off groceries at their front door using Jeff Bezos's nice tricks and otherwise indulging themselves in streaming. So I didn't think that that was even a possibility. I thought everything was more or less fixable. The constitutions worked, the Bill of Rights was intact, the courts worked, and that they couldn't get away with what I knew for a fact that they were planning, which were these lockdowns. And I've been writing about these, you know, the possibility of universal quarantines since about 2005. I didn't like that the power existed and that people imagined that they would do it. But I never really thought through the implications of the possibility that it would actually happen. So when it came to that time where the models jumped off the page and into your life, you know, that was March 2020. And you know, Trump very naively fell into it. But he didn't have any idea it's hard to understand a person's motivations, but I don't think he understood the scale of what was taking place. When he greenlighted all this stuff, he thought it was going to be temporary. There'd be a vaccine, and he'd be a hero. Well, that didn't happen. It unleashed every beast in American life, and ruined the culture and society and economy So why? So this is you ask a very serious question. The question of, you know, was everything really rotten? Was the foundation of freedom and civilization already corroded to the point that it just needed a little push and everything would fall out? I mean, maybe that's where we were, and I just didn't know it. But I will say that in 2019, I was pretty darn naive, and I thought everything was basically work. You know, we had a lot of tweaks to, we could make, but that things worked. Year later, nothing worked, and here we are four years later, and everything is broken. Trust is gone completely. You know, I quite often go back, because in those days after lockdowns where everything seemed so ghastly and lonely and I felt like a lone voice, I think there were a number of us, but we couldn't find each other because censorship began right away. I was scouring the papers for some hint of truth out there about the drama of what was happening, because everybody's pretending, oh, this is normal that you can't go visit your mother in the nursing home you're paying for. Really? No, you can't go to church. Singing is dangerous.
Yeah. Well, we're all in this together, right?
Yeah, right. So people were acting like, oh, that's just what you do. Well, there was one article in the Wall Street Journal that I read very, very carefully, and it was by, of all people, Henry Kissinger. This is before he died. It was like one of his last public articles, actually. And he was reflecting on the pandemic response. And, you know, as is his way, you know, he was dialing everything back. It was dry. It was realpolitik, as he always liked to say. But right at the end of it, he says, look, if this pandemic response doesn't work, if governments misuse their power and go too far and everything breaks, the world will catch fire. That was his words, that the world will be on fire. And that was it, you know? And I thought, wow, okay. What does that mean from Henry Kissinger's point of view, for the world to be on fire? And I think what I can't put words in his mouth, but what he might have meant is that the elite establishment, the power, the overlords that have worked for decades and decades and decades to construct this sort of global apparatus of control and stabilize political systems and control powerful media outlets and medicine and science and universities and so on, that all of that will burn down in the face of public outrage. I think that's what he might have meant. And that seems to be exactly what is happening right now. It is all burning down.
Is that a good thing? Maybe that's what needs to happen. Well, what emerges from this fire? Are we going to emerge from the ashes freer, or are we just going to be more living under more tyranny after the burning's finished?
You know, a lot of that, it comes down to us, and it depends on whether we become rebuilders or just nihilists. Are we going to become, you know, the Batman or the Joker? I mean, that's really the question. So it really, I think it comes down to, you know, what are our attitudes. I think it's interesting what you said earlier about shopping at big corporate venues. Like, you know for sure that if you go to a mainstream grocery store, you're kind of supporting the bad guys. I mean, at many levels. I mean, not just the corporate establishment, but big food, you know, for example, which, if you'd asked me again 5 years ago, what's wrong with American food, I would have said nothing. Now that, you know, the loss of trust makes you look into things and you realize the food is actually poisoned. And I don't want to support these things anymore. So I think you're right. You know, going to your local venues, getting as far back to the source of things as possible is just a step in the right direction. And if we all kind of take these steps in every aspect of our life, like, don't take your doctor's word for it. You know, don't accept every medicine that they're trying to dish out to you. You know, turn off CNBC and CNN. Don't give it a dime to NPR and so on. So these seem like maybe not that big a deal, but actually they're a huge deal if it becomes a population-wide movement. And I think, you know, we may be headed that way. And it's not just in the US. Like, we can't forget that the pandemic response and everything they did to us was a global response. I mean, it happened all throughout the EU and the Commonwealth countries, including Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Latin America pretended to comply. Africa was the least, you know, they were like, nope, sorry, we're not going to do this. This is stupid.
Yeah.
And they had, by the way, outstanding results from that. And only one really major Western country refused to go along, and that was Sweden. And that's for reasons that are fairly interesting. But the point was, it was a global response, which means that the discrediting of the elites who did this to us, the censors and the medical monopolies, public health establishment, and governments around the world, you know, are all being discredited at the same time. That's why you're seeing these farmers' protests all over the EU against the green energy stuff. A political revolution that sort of beckons all over the world. And with that comes pushback, you know, to install approved leaders, even if they're clownishly ridiculous, like Biden, right? I mean, so there's a huge push to get him in office, which is going to require the dismantling of democracy itself. So that's sort of where we are. And it's I would say, extremely dangerous times. But, you know, here's the thing. It's not dangerous because of the resistance. It's dangerous because we're dealing with a discredited power structure that is insisting that it's their right to rule the world forever. They can't stand, you know, the possibility of letting go. And so they have enemyized us and censored us and are finding every conceivable excuse to marginalize us and make us comply. And so really the question of the future really is the extent to determined by the extent to which human beings are willing to live in cages forever. And I think the answer to that is probably we're not. And we're not gonna put up with this. But how that unfolds and how long it takes is another issue.
Well, let's look at history. I mean, if you look at tyrannical regimes, they usually either have a massive collapse, currency failure, change, a coup. It could be bloody. It could be violent. Are there a lot of examples of Western-style democracy? We'll put democracy in quote because, you know, we're banning gas-powered cars without a single vote of the U.S. Congress authorizing it. The California legislature never authorized it. But executive orders, unelected bureaucrats, corporate government collusion are banning it. Going back through, like, Western history, I mean, I'm not that interested in that. Where is a model situation historically in country similar to the United States, or at least Western, that has sort of evolved out of this sort of corporate government collusion, tyranny, administrative state overreach? Can we just sort of lightly revolt and grow our way out? Or are we looking at a lot worse before it could possibly get better?
We've never lived through this level of statist, totalitarian, corporatist control before, where you've got these major conglomerates, you know, with medicine and media and digital tech and government all combining to poison the population. You know, I mean, like, and censor us. We've never seen anything like this, and nor have we seen what you just described. You know, what does the revolt look like? And when I started thinking about this, I really did ask a lot of friends of mine who were, you know, better at various aspects of history, whether it's Rome or the fall of the Portuguese Empire, or the fall of Spain, and ask for a precedent here, and nobody could come up with one. And your conditions you mentioned are the important ones: highly industrialized,
yes,
ostensibly living under the rule of law, which you could never say about, say, Russia. Even the industrialized questions, you know, it's iffy in the case of the Soviet Union. But we have, you know, courts that pretend to function. We still have this constitution that every day the New York Times makes fun of, as they did once again today. They made fun of it. They called it antiquarian, antiquated and dysfunctional constitution, U.S. Constitution, is the New York Times today. So we've never seen anything like this, with this level of prosperity And an ostensible democratic industrialized country facing what really amounts to kind of a traditional revolution, where you have, you know, a 1% of the ruling class trying to impose itself on the 99% that don't want to go along. You know, you mentioned the case of cars, but I mean, we can multiply that across, you know, all technologies and food and medicine and everything. It's unbelievable. They have a plan for our lives. We don't like it. What are we going to do about it? So we don't really have a historical precedent for what this looks like. You know, if things were not this bad, you could imagine a reform movement that would work. You know, like we had some pretty dramatic reforms take place in the late 1980s and the early, the late 1970s and the early 1980s in this country with, you know, with a public revolt against the Carter administration, against the inflation of the times. But the problems then seemed like nothing, like a drop in the bucket, drop in the ocean compared to what we're dealing with now. So we reformed our way out of that through deregulation, tax cuts, you know, morning in America kind of reforms. They didn't go far enough, but they were a step in the, you know, towards natural healing at some level. But the problems are much, much worse now. So I don't think a normal reform movement is going to work. I don't think there's any reason to be optimistic about politics until we get, you know, a large majority of lawmakers in there that really represent the aspirations of the average person, which we don't right now. And too often is the case that these guys get power and they become part of the problem. And I think that's where we are right now. But if we had, you know, an entire Congress filled with Tom Massey's, and we had, you know, a president like RFK with appointees that shared his vision on things, you know, we might be able to see some normal change. I just don't think that's that we're there yet. We're not there yet. But here's the other option. People within the ruling class realize that this level of draconian despotic control over the population is unsustainable. And they start worrying about their own future, you know, and so reforms come boil up from within. I mean, maybe that's possible. That's what I thought was going to happen. That doesn't seem to be happening right now. In fact, we see just the opposite. But we'll have to wait and see. You know, it's kind of interesting to think that we're living in times where we're writing a new history that generations from now will look back on as a precedent for how they're going to deal with their problems. So we are really in, as far as I can tell, new territory.
All right, we're talking with Jeffrey Tucker, founder, president of the Brownstone Institute, author of Life After Lockdowns. We'll be right back after these messages and continue our talk with Jeffrey Tucker. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm your retirement fear. But don't be scared. You're still in pre-retirement.
Does that mean I have more time to plan?
Precisely. Here, this is pretirement.org.
Retirement savings options? Potential tax breaks?
Boom.
This isn't scary. I'm doing it.
You got this.
Visit thisispretirement.org for free resources to help you customize your action plan.
Examining the issues. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We're continuing our talk with Jeffrey Tucker, the founder, president of the Brownstone Institute and author of the book Life After Lockdown. Let me give you three quick examples, Jeffrey, of resistance. You had Sri Lanka, who in coordination with the World Economic Forum basically ended all conventional agriculture, went all organic, had the highest ESG score, and the whole country collapsed to where the peasants overran the presidential palace and swam in the swimming pool. The president had to exile. Then you have the case of the Canadian truckers revolting against this dystopia. They were, of course, revolting against the COVID lockdowns and then the vaccine mandates. Justin Trudeau, for the first time in Canadian history, invoked the Canadian Emergencies Act, declared them domestic terrorists. Basically, metaphorically, picked up the phone, called the truckers' insurance and said, these are terrorists, cancel their insurance. The private companies went right along. They called up the banks, and then the banks cut off access to the truckers' own money. It's not like they cut off government assets. They didn't have access to their own bank accounts. And anyone who bought them coffee or made donuts could have the same threat made. And then you also have the most recent example you referenced, that the farmers in Europe, they seem to be the most successful. They've actually halted temporarily the Green New Deal in Europe. The EU just voted to halt key agricultural provisions, restrictions on agriculture because of the farmer protests. And they're spraying manure on buildings near the EU headquarters in Brussels. So given those three examples, you have the one president overrun, you have Canada, where essentially they were declared terrorists and Justin Trudeau came down with the iron fist. And it looks like the most successful so far is Europe. Is that a model? By what can those three lessons teach us about what we can do here in America to fight back?
Those are interesting and instructive cases. On the other hand, they weren't decisive victories because in the case of the EU, you have censorship like we don't even know in the U.S. I'm going there in a couple of weeks to meet with a whole series of European intellectual dissidents. I'm going to learn a little more about what's going on the ground. It's hard to tell from the newspapers, but The EU really does need to be dismantled as an institution, and the idea of the European Union itself needs to just go. I'm sorry, but you know, a lot of this was kicked off by Brexit and the fury on the part of the powerful elites that the UK wanted out. And they're still not entirely out. They've been trying for a long time. They're still dealing with this. That whole apparatus needs to be dismantled entirely. Like Brussels needs to be completely defunded. And you know, this can happen peacefully or it can happen not peacefully. That's the worry. The case of Canada. Wow, you talk about public anger. The courts, by the way, have ruled against Trudeau's declaration of emergency and said it was basically illegal. But you have not seen any apologies there at all. And just the public anger. And you know, it takes a lot to get a Canadian mad. But the level of estrangement between the government on one hand and the people on the other is gigantic. I assume that this is going to be a long-term process. We're talking about 5, 10, 20 years of gradual reforms are going to take place. That's my best guess. And you know, the path to resistance for us in this country is to do it in every way you possibly can. And actually, there are more means to us available than we normally think. You know, it all has to do with, you know, where you're living, the choices you make over your children's school, where you're buying your groceries, you know, how you spend your money, where you invest your money. These kinds of things are going to make, I think, a more dramatic difference even than something like a trucker's revolt. One of the major problems we have in this country is that basically people are afraid to get out in public protests anymore. You know, after what happened after the January 6th, many people were embroiled in that situation, you know, completely innocently. You know, it didn't actually harm anyone, and they find themselves, you know, visited by the FBI and then hauled off to prison. So people are pretty scared right now in this country, even to engage in public revolts. I don't think it's going to take those traditional routes. It's going to be a different kind of revolt. One thing people can really stop doing is stop using censored venues and rally around the uncensored ones. And we still have those opportunities that remain to us to get to the truth and to stop believing the propaganda. So that is going to make, I think, the biggest difference for now. And we have a slight window of opportunity because, like, What's really going on, and I hate to alarm people, but you know, the ambition is full control of the internet, which means full surveillance of your life. You know, like everything you do is going to be surveilled and controlled by all the top. That's the ambition. That seems crazy, but that's what they've set out to do. They want to do to the United States what they've done in China and what they're doing in Brazil. So we just can't allow them to take that next step. That's the most important thing. And we to the extent we still have elements of capitalism remaining, you are in charge of how you spend your time and how you spend your money. Yeah. So you can support the good guys in the struggle and defund the other ones. So that is a matter of public enlightenment. And I think that's right now going to have a more long-term effect than anything else.
All right, in the few minutes we have left, tell us a little bit about the presidential race. I mean, we don't have to spend time on Joe Biden, but
yeah,
a lot of people worried about this. It's a choice between Trump and RFK Jr. Where do you fall? I mean, you may have heard me say, I think RFK is phenomenally articulate, phenomenally laying out all these issues. And I feel like for the most part, Trump doesn't get it. But what are your thoughts? Yeah.
RFK faces the problem that people vote strategically, which doesn't mean that they're always going to vote for the person that they like the most. What they're going to do is vote against the person they fear the most. And in that case, he could see a lot of defections out of his camp to one or the other. Right now, it looks like he's going to cost Biden more votes than he'll cost Trump. The other thing to remember is that, like, as we speak right now, the betting odds favor a Biden victory.
I believe Biden's going to win. My simple sentence is, I don't believe that the powers that be are going to allow a Trump victory. They'll do what they need to make sure. It's not going to be the same thing they did in 2020. It'll be a new method.
Yeah,
whatever.
I think that's most likely correct. However, I did bump into a note of optimism. And when I say optimism, I don't mean like I think the answer is Donald Trump. I don't, but what makes me think that there's a chance that Biden will lose is a little notice sent out by the Office of Personnel Management the other day, which is the overarching governing structure of the administrative state. And they're trying to entrench the 2 million civil servants in the federal government, which includes the security agencies and also everybody else, all 430 agencies. Entrench them against executive orders that would loosen job protections for them. So what I'm thinking is that they would not have seen a need to pass this new order, which does in fact erect new legal barriers to a Schedule F style Trump order. They would not have seen a need for it if they didn't perceive a threat. So I think the threat is authentic and, I just don't know how pressing it is, but I do think it's real. I think it's too soon just to say, oh, we have no hope. We're never going to win this. I think there's a chance that Biden can lose.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate this. Jeffrey Tucker, founder of the Brownstone Institute, author of Life After Lockdown. Thank you for joining us on TNT Unleashed. And I urge everyone to follow your writings. As I said, you are one of the most articulate voices on spot on for the times in which we live right now. So thank you so much.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We're going to take a break and we'll be back for the next hour. Stay tuned.